concerns of a growing global hunger crisis as Russia again blocks Ukraine grain exports.
This is a very serious situation. We need to move forward. The initiative is bound for renewal on 17 July. Global hunger hotspots are increasing.
Plus, residents in one of Russia's other neighbors see the success of Ukraine as a chance to take back their own sovereignty.
If Ukraine will win, hope it will win, we will have more chance. If they will not, we will have no chance.
And celebrating sexual minorities, June marks the start of Pride Month in the U.S. as state-led efforts continue to restrict the rights of Americans who identify as transgender. Today is Friday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Air raid alerts were declared across all of Ukraine early on Friday in the wake of fresh Russian missile launches. Authorities in Kyiv reported two separate waves of attacks. Russia has launched about 20 separate missile and drone strikes against Ukrainian cities since the start of May. The latest barrage comes as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky took his request for more arms and support to Moldova and the start of a summit of the European political community. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamus reports.
President Volodymyr Zelensky also told a summit of some 50 European leaders in Moldova that his country needed a clear invitation to NATO.
Every European country that borders Russia and that does not want Russia to tear it apart should be a full member of the EU and NATO.
The meeting of the Pan-Continental EPC, which embraces all European nations other than Russia and Belarus, gathered the heads of state and government from 47 countries. The event seeks to quell regional conflicts and shore up unity in the face of Russia's war. It focused on countries south and east as the region has reached a turning point with Moscow over its invasion of Ukraine. I'm Karen Chamas.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's Ministry of Renovation and Infrastructure says a UN-brokered grain export deal has again been halted as Russia blocked registration of ships to all Ukrainian ports. In May, Russia agreed to a two-month extension of the deal. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric raised concerns about the consequences at a news conference in New York on Thursday.
This is a very serious situation. We need to move forward. The initiative is bound for renewal on 17 July. Global hunger hotspots are increasing, as we've been notifying you on a regular basis, and the specter of food inflation and market volatility lurks in all countries.
The UN and Turkey brokered the Black Sea Grain Initiative between Moscow and Kyiv last July to help tackle a global food crisis aggravated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a leading global grain exporter. Amid fresh strikes in Kyiv and as Ukraine readies its counteroffensive against Russia, another former Soviet republic is watching closely. In 2008, the Russian army attacked Georgia, cementing the occupation of breakaway regions. Now, as Georgia's population looks firmly westward, some accuse its government of leaning toward Moscow, risking Georgian hopes of joining the European Union. Lisa Bryant reports from the capital, Tbilisi, near the border of South Ossetia.
Here in north-central Georgia, Russia is never far away. Barriers cut through Kervaleti village, separating South Ossetia from the rest of the country. European Union monitors help ensure stability along what's called the administrative boundary line. Plesmas is spokesman for the European Union monitoring mission in Georgia.
We are particularly at this spot here today because it's a very visual point to see how indeed the conflict for many people is not over.
It's certainly not over in Saravani settlement, a few dozen kilometers away. It houses thousands of people displaced by the South Ossetian conflict 15 years ago. Today, life seems almost normal. But some here believe what's happening in Ukraine, thousands of miles away, might determine Georgia's chances of retaking its own territory and going home. Nansha Kruli is an internally displaced person and the director of a local nonprofit.
If Ukraine will win, hope it will win, we will have more chance. If they will not, we will have no chance.
In the capital, Tbilisi, and elsewhere in the country, many Georgians are rooting for Ukraine. and to join the European Union. In this former Soviet republic, the birthplace of hardline Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, there are strong feelings, too, about Russia, including the thousands of Russians who have arrived for business or political reasons since Moscow invaded Ukraine.
Russians who are here must go home. Must go home.
Critics say the ruling Georgian Dream Party does not reflect the country's pro-Western bent. Moscow's resumption of flights to Tbilisi in May, marking warming ties between the two countries, was met with protests here. There were massive demonstrations earlier this year against a so-called foreign agents bill for groups receiving funding from abroad. The government ultimately dropped the legislation, which critics denounced as again bringing Georgia closer to Russia. Irakli Pojkizde is vice president of the Georgian Institute for Strategic Studies.
Basically, the entire Georgian population for quite some time, the majority of it, has been supporting the pro-European future of Georgia, but also integration with NATO. And of course, the government these days has been going against that wave.
Georgian Dream Party lawmakers say they are committed to democracy and to Europe, but must walk a pragmatic line faced with their powerful Russian neighbor. For now, the party appears to have more popular support than the opposition. Two big events are coming up. The EU will reconsider Georgia's candidacy application after having recommended a set of reforms, and Georgia's 2024 elections. Both could determine where the country is heading in the months and years to come. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tbilisi.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, speaking after a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Oslo, Norway on Thursday, called on Kosovo and Serbia to take immediate steps to reduce post-election ethnic tensions that have led to violent protests in the region.
We support the process of Euro-Atlantic integration for Kosovo and for Serbia, but the current escalation hinders rather than helps the efforts to move in that direction.
Blinken also addressed the ongoing violence in Sudan.
And now we're seeing actions again by both sides in clear violation of the commitments they've made in terms of the ceasefire. So that also is not the right direction to be heading, and it's certainly not what's in the interests of the people of Sudan. We'll continue to be engaged at the same time. We're also looking at steps that we can take to make clear our views on any leaders who are moving Sudan in the wrong direction, including by perpetuating the violence.
The U.S. issued economic and travel sanctions Thursday for both the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces for violating the ceasefire agreement, which Blinken said is hindering the delivery of humanitarian assistance and hurting those who need it most. We're also following these stories from around the world. Senegal's interior minister reported on state television early Friday that 9 people were killed in unrest on Thursday after protests broke out over the sentencing of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. Almost 24 people have died from cholera just outside South Africa's capital, Pretoria, over the past 2 weeks, and hundreds have been hospitalized. Critics blame government mismanagement and corruption for the rare outbreak. Officials are searching now for the source of the cholera. The Islamic Republic of Iran carried out 142 executions last month, the highest number of people executed in 1 month since 2015. The Oslo-based Iran Human Rights Organization says more than half of the executions were due to drug-related crimes, while the rest were allegedly for the Islamic crimes of blasphemy, adultery, and so-called spreading corruption on earth. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. A new study says Earth has pushed past 7 out of 8 scientifically established safety limits and into the danger zone, not just for an overheating planet, but for the well-being of the people living on it. The study by the international science group Earth Commission, published in the May 31st Journal of Nature, looks at not just the guardrails for the planetary ecosystem, but for the first time, it includes measures of justice, which is mostly about preventing harm for groups of people. The study looks at climate, air pollution, pollution, phosphorus contamination, nitrogen pollution, groundwater supplies, fresh surface water, the unbuilt natural environment, and the overall natural and human-built environment. The scientists say it's not a terminal diagnosis, and the planet can recover if changes are made. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Australia's most decorated living soldier has lost a defamation case over newspaper claims he committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith had sued three Australian newspapers and three journalists over a series of articles in 2018 that he says defamed him. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This was the first time any court had assessed allegations of war crimes by Australian forces. Ben Robert Smith, a former corporal in the Australian SAS, had sued Australian media outlets over articles that he said defamed him. He said they portrayed him as a callous man who'd ignored the moral and legal codes of war. His lawyers have said the trial evidence was inconsistent and fanciful. Three newspapers claimed the former SAS corporal was involved in the murders of six unarmed prisoners or civilians in Afghanistan more than a decade ago. They alleged he'd used a machine gun to kill a captured fighter whose artificial leg was then taken as a trophy. The newspapers insisted their news stories were truthful and accurate. The death of Ali Jan in the Afghan village of Darwan in September 2012 was one of the most shocking allegations. Justice Anthony Bosanco found that on the balance of probabilities, Robert Smith kicked the handcuffed prisoner off a cliff before ordering his execution. The journalist Nick McKenzie, who was sued for defamation, told reporters outside the federal court in Sydney Thursday that it was an act of brutality.
Ali Jan was a father. Ali Jan was a husband. He has children who no longer have a father. He has a wife who no longer has a husband. He was kicked off a cliff by Ben Robert Smith and he was murdered with Ben Robert Smith's participation.
Justice Bosanco said the three newspapers had proven some of the most serious allegations against Ben Robert Smith. The judge's full decision will be published next Monday. This was a civil, not a criminal trial. The judgment was not a criminal finding of guilt, but the high-profile defamation case does raise the possibility that a man once regarded as an Australian hero could be charged with war crimes. In 2020, a report found credible evidence that Australian forces had killed 39 civilians and prisoners in Afghanistan between 2007 and 2013. So far, criminal charges have been laid against one military veteran. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
June in the United States marks LGBTQ Pride Month, a celebration of sexual minority communities, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. This year's Pride Month coincides with state-led efforts to restrict the rights of Americans who identify as transgender and cordon off drag queens from broader society. Meanwhile, Uganda's president has defended signing one of the world's harshest anti-LGBTQ laws, telling party members that homosexuality is a, quote, sickness, and shrugging off Western threats of aid cuts. From Reuters, David Doyle has more.
The signing is finished. Nobody will move us.
Uganda's president has defended signing one of the world's harshest anti-LGBTQ laws. At a meeting of his National Resistance Movement party, Yoweri Museveni said the legislation, which includes the death penalty, was needed to prevent LGBTQ community members who were disoriented from recruiting others.
It's not genetic, it's not hormonal, it is psychological disorientation where somebody, because of some experience, hates the people he should love and loves the people he should not love. It's a type of like a sickness.
The law imposes capital punishment for so-called aggravated homosexuality and a life sentence for same-sex intercourse. A 20-year jail term can be handed down for the promotion of homosexuality. The legislation has triggered widespread Western criticism, including threats by US President Joe Biden and others to cut aid and impose sanctions.
If they cut aid, we shall sit down and discipline our expenditure, rearrange our budgets. If they interfere with our trade, we shall trade with others.
Homosexuality was already illegal in Uganda, a conservative and deeply religious country where members of the LGBT community already face ostracism and harassment by security forces.
David Doyle reporting for Reuters. Rising gun violence and mass shootings have destroyed families and communities across America. A California woman who lost her own son to gun violence has turned her grief into hope with a gun buyback program where the surrendered weapons are turned into art. I spoke with Patty Navalta, founder and executive director of the Robbie Pobletti Foundation.
You've really made it your life's work to combat gun violence, having had the worst imaginable tragedy hit right at home for you. Can you say what happened in your own life?
Sure. So in 2014, my son, Robbie Pobletti, was killed by gun violence. He was shot in broad daylight at a busy intersection in Vallejo, California, where he was born and raised. I would say a week before he was shot and killed, he had laid out his suit on his bed because he was going to go through a job interview process for where he had been working as a temporary worker, and they were about to offer him that job. So he had his suit laid out on his bed, and actually that became the suit that he was buried in. And that was so compelling for me. I'll never forget that detail, because, you know, that's what gun violence does in an instant, in a second, because it's so easily accessible. You can change the course of someone's life completely, where a suit that you intended to wear to a job interview is the suit that you're buried in.
There are too many incidents since then to even start to list. It's been getting worse, going in the wrong direction since you've been advocating for this, but you have a really unique program, a good way to sort of put a spin on all of this horrific stuff. Tell us a little bit about your Gun Buyback for Art program.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I want to explain why I came up with this idea. My son's life was taken by a weapon that was obtained illegally, and after it was used to take his life, it was resold on the streets where it was used to commit another crime. And so this saying that even if we take one weapon off the streets, it's worth it, that to me is not an overstatement, because one weapon can be recirculated on the streets to commit numerous crimes and impact numerous lives. So that's where I got the idea of getting as many unwanted firearms out of circulation as possible, which would be a gun buyback. You know, most police departments don't have a budget for that, so we created a nonprofit where we would raise the money that would purchase gift cards in exchange for people surrendering their weapons. What I asked after that was, what happens to the weapons once they're collected? Because my son at the time was learning how to weld, and he was collecting a lot of scrap metal. He also had a very artistic side, so he wanted to use his welding skills to take this scrap metal and turn into art. So I had this idea of getting the materials from the weapons once they were dismantled and putting them in the hands of artists, where we could really transform the meaning of this metal, you know, and the purpose of it, and really transform something that was created to destroy and harm people and transform it into something that could inspire and that could really open up a dialogue, a meaningful dialogue about gun violence. And so that's what we did. It's called the Art of Peace, and it's been implemented now in numerous cities and states, actually. And every exhibit is different because the art that's created by local hands are always different. They always tell a different story of that community, and it's always unique to them. And surprisingly to me, it was just an idea for me, but it has been enormously powerful in allowing people in communities to talk about gun violence in a way that's human-centered rather than political.
These exhibits are now all over the country?
Well, every time we have a gun buyback or we are able to obtain firearms that have been adjudicated and dismantled, that's where we have the Art of Peace exhibit. It started in Vallejo, California, where my son was killed. We had an exhibit there. Once we exhibit them, we auction the art, and then the whatever profits we make go right back into the next gun buyback. So it's a program that sustains itself. What happened after we launched it in Vallejo, California, was Richmond, California, which also had a high rate of gun violence, called us and said, can you do a gun buyback here, and can we do an art of peace here? So that was the next one. The third one was in Oakland, California, had a high rate of gun violence. Their district attorney, they had years and years of stored up firearms that had been adjudicated. So these are guns taken into evidence, you know, guns that were actually used in crimes. And they launched an art of peace in Oakland, California, which actually was a huge exhibit, had beautiful works of art.
How do you manage to stay hopeful?
There were 2 years after my son was killed that I was not hopeful. I felt completely helpless. That to me is the feeling that most people who pick up guns feel. They feel helpless. They feel like there is no other option for them. There's no one who cares. There's no opportunity. There are no doors open, because I really don't believe anyone grows up thinking, I want to lead a life of crime. I want to pick up a gun one day and I want to take someone's life. That comes out of hopelessness. So I can't allow myself to reach those depths. And of course, that doesn't mean I don't get deeply disappointed. And I have PTSD. You know, every time I hear news about a mass shooting, I think about the parents who are going to get those calls, because I remember what it's like yesterday getting that call. But if we don't do something to combat it, then we all fall into this pool of hopelessness. And I just refuse to do that. I know the difference that I'm making every time we get one weapon off the street, every time it's dismantled, every time we then reveal that piece of art and there are tears in people's eyes and we talk about how gun violence has impacted that community. And another part of our program is we provide scholarships for people coming in the reentry population so that they can obtain lifelong skills in the trades. We pay for their boots, their books, their tools, their union dues, all the way through job placement. So it's the way to combat hopelessness is to provide hope for other people. And that's what we're doing. So the way to combat hopelessness is to provide hope for other people. And that's what we're doing.
Patty Navalta, founder and executive director of the Robbie Pobletti Foundation. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late March, a force of Malian soldiers backed by mercenaries belonging to the Russia-backed Wagner Group, a transnational criminal organization, set out on a five-day military counterterrorism operation to Moura, a village in the Mopti region of central Mali. By the time the operation was done, at least 500 people lay dead. There were reports of torture, and at least 58 women and girls were subjected to sexual violence, including rape. In late May, the United States Department of State imposed visa restrictions on the leaders of the two Malian units that participated in the operation. Colonel Mustafa Sangare commanded the 33rd Parachute Commando Regiment at the time, and Major Lassine Togola was acting commander of the Autonomous Special Forces Battalion. The two men are being sanctioned under Section 7031C of the Department of State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Appropriations Act for their involvement in gross violations of human rights. At the same time, the U.S. Justice Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated Ivan Alexandrovich Maslov, pursuant to Executive Order 14024, for having acted for or on behalf of the Wagner Group. Maslov is the leader and principal administrator of the Wagner Group's paramilitary units in Mali. Maslov was charged with leading the Mali branch by Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin and Valerievich Utkin, the Wagner Group's top leader and its founder, respectively. Both had previously been sanctioned by the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and Canada. In his capacity as the leader and principal administrator of the Wagner Group in Mali, Maslov has worked closely with Malian government officials to execute the group's deployment there. He arranges meetings between Prigozhin and government officials from a number of African nations and has worked to carry out the Wagner Group's interests in the extractive sector. Treasury sanctions against the most senior Wagner Group representative in Mali identify and disrupt a key operative supporting the group's global activities, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. The Wagner Group's presence on the African continent is a destabilizing force for any country that allows for the deployment of the group's resources into their sovereign territory.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.